reevaluating Jacksonville's Confederate history. Good Tuesday morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. You can also listen to the audio feed of the show right now on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Just ahead, honored heritage or hateful symbols. The debate in Jacksonville and across the South over what to do with the region's many Confederate monuments. Where do you stand on that? Give us a call. 549-2937. Then later, the grandson of Nelson Mandela comes to town. A preview of his talk on the UNF campus. Plus, it's the highlighting of STEM education. We'll look ahead to this weekend's Jacksonville Science Festival, all of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, they are scattered throughout the city, statues and other monuments to the Confederacy. From the memorial to Confederate soldiers in Hemming Park, to the Yellow Bluff Fort on the north side, Confederate Park in Springfield, and many more, reminders of the region's Civil War past are easy to find around town. But for African American residents, who make up more than 30% of Jacksonville's population, continuing to honor the Confederacy, which fought to preserve slavery, is an ongoing affront. Cities across the South have grappled with this tangled legacy of their Confederate monuments. And cities in the North have, too, actually. Some have been torn down. In other cities, debate has erupted and the monuments have stayed. Recently, Jacksonville Magazine decided to focus on the issue, and they received quite a bit of feedback. So we're going to continue the discussion on that right now as we begin the hour with a closer look at Jacksonville's Confederate monuments. Here in studio, Joe White, editor of Jacksonville Magazine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Local activist Shavara Oren, who was interviewed for the story.
Good morning.
And Jacksonville historian Wayne Wood.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks so much for being here, everyone. And here's our question to callers. What is your position on Jacksonville's monuments to the Confederacy? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can comment on our Facebook page, and you can listen to the audio feed right on Facebook as well. Joe White, let's begin with you. You mentioned to me recently when you decided to focus on this in the magazine, you got a larger than anticipated amount of feedback, pretty strong emotions about this.
Yeah, I think any publication worth reading is one that's going to have a conversation with the readers, and you want to sometimes provoke them into thinking about things from that they might think about a lot already, but maybe from a different angle. And so when we were able to kind of put this story together, and certainly it's not a new topic, it's been discussed certainly in recent months, even to greater awareness. So we're able to put it on paper, and I shouldn't say I was that surprised. I knew, considering the environment, that people were going to have some reaction. I was surprised by the lengths that some people will go. I got letters that were a page and a half long, documenting family histories and all these kinds of things that they were being pulled out that unsolicited. So it was pretty interesting to see.
Shavar Oren, you were interviewed for this story. Of course, when Charleston, South Carolina, saw the massacre of 9 African-American parishioners at an AME church, and South Carolina decided to take down its Confederate flag from atop its Capitol building. That was emblematic, I think, of the debate over these symbols of the Confederacy throughout the South, including here in Jacksonville, where we have a statue of Andrew Jackson. We have the Confederate Memorial in Hemming Park and many others. These are offensive symbols to so many residents of this city, including you. When you talk about these issues, you've mentioned that you're not in favor of tearing them down, but you are in favor of reframing the narrative around these symbols. Could you explain how you see that?
Sure. My personal perspective certainly informs how I feel about this issue. My mother is a white Jewish woman. My great-grandfather, my paternal grandfather, is Burl Bevel, and he was enslaved on a cotton plantation. He was born in 1837. And so when I think about Jacksonville and our inability to be truth-tellers, to be bold, courageous truth-tellers. You mentioned Charleston. One of the things that Charleston has done as recently as 2014, they've installed a memorial, a statue of Denmark Vesey. He's the leader of a failed slave uprising in Charleston in 1822 as a counterpoint to some of these other memorials and statues that exist. And as you mentioned, I'm not opposed to allowing these statues to remain in designated public places, if the narrative is reframed. I think the truth needs to be told. Authentic efforts need to be made by our city and its leaders to remedy structural racism that currently exists, not just in our city, but across the nation.
And we'll go to your calls about Jacksonville's and the South's Confederate monuments in a moment at 549-2937. Wayne Wood, you are, of course, a local historian. There is passionate debate about this all over the states that used to make up the old Confederacy. For example, in New Orleans, they decided to take down a monument, and the contractor they hired to do it started receiving death threats, and they had to put a hold on those plans. This evokes strong emotions and even threats of physical harm, which shows you how personally people that are Southern natives take this issue. They see removing these monuments as an affront to their heritage.
Well, I'm grateful for Jacksonville Magazine starting this conversation because it's one that our community needs to address. And I'm grateful for you for having this as a topic on your show.
Sure.
This is a debate that's going on not just in Jacksonville, of course, but throughout the South and throughout the nation. And we need to realize that although our history is our established heritage, you can't change history, but you certainly need to be able to reflect and have a modern perspective on what these historic monuments mean. Many of the historic monuments, like the Hemming Park Monument and the Monument to the Women of the Confederacy in Springfield Park, are works of art as well as historic monuments. And so the symbolism and the placement of those sometimes is the more important, like having a Confederate flag flying over a state house. That's a serious issue when one-third of the people who walk through Hemming Park are offended by having a Confederate monument in the middle of it. It's a debate that needs to be had and does not have an easy solution. As Shavara mentioned, and I agree with her on this, having it balanced with memorials to different parts of the population. So it's not just one side of the story that we tell all sides of the story. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, we have no statue to James Weldon Johnson, to Eartha White, to James, to A. Philip Randolph, Rutledge Pearson, other great African-American nationally significant people. And perhaps by balancing these displays, it would help to quell some of the controversy.
We have streets named after civil rights heroes and schools, Joe White, but it seems as though cities reserve the big glory, the monuments and statues for the heroes of the Confederacy. And the controversy, of course, comes from the fact that, particularly for African-American residents, but not only African-American residents, it's seen as glorifying those who fought to preserve an evil institution. And so when you talk about the feedback you're getting at Jack's Mag, how much was pro keeping the monuments and how much was more in the favor of either removing them or reframing them?
I'd say most was pro in the idea of keeping the monuments, but not even so much keeping the monuments, but more along the line of that history shouldn't be forgotten or paved over. And if anything, to Wayne's point, I think Jacksonville probably does a poor job in showcasing some of the history that has taken place here and some of the individuals who have significant contributions not only to Florida but to the entire nation. Mm-hmm. Either living here or growing up here. And making contributions while they were here. And so I think, larger things, we don't do a good job of sharing all of that.
And on Thursday, we're going to welcome to the show former State Senator Tony Hill. He's organizing a tribute on Friday to the late James Weldon Johnson that will happen in the La Villa neighborhood. Shavara, as Wayne pointed out, there's no statute to James Weldon Johnson or A. Philip Randolph in Jacksonville, who are national heroes of the civil rights movement and hailed from Jacksonville. Let me ask you about this as well. They're trying to take down a sculpture of Edmund Kirby Smith, who was from St. Augustine and a Confederate general, removing it from the National Statuary Hall in Washington. But there's been it remains in limbo. Removing these monuments is easier said than done. In other words, that's a symbol, I guess, the Kirby Smith situation of what happens when a decision is made to take a monument like that down.
Well, part of the challenge, and thank you for bringing up history as facts and figures too, Wayne. James Loewen, who's a foremost anti-racist historian, says that he believes that history shouldn't be taught as straightforward facts and dates to memorize, but rather as an analysis of the context and root causes of events. And when I think about the Confederacy in particular, part of the very real challenge for me and many others in the Black community that I have had conversations with is the revisionist history of the Confederacy. We act as though the Confederacy and the war was not about slavery, when in fact it was. As a matter of fact, Texas made very clear that they were seceding because of white supremacy. They said, "We hold as undeniable truths that the governments of the various states and of the Confederacy itself were established exclusively by the white race for themselves and their posterity, that the African race had no agency in their establishment, that they were rightfully held and regarded as an inferior and dependent race." And that is the basis of the war. And so a big part of the challenge is that we haven't gotten history right yet. We're not telling the truth. So the Confederate statues and monuments that we have placards that indicate only part of the story.
Yeah. And it's striking, too, when you look at our history around race. We've never had the reckoning, for example, that South Africa had when apartheid ended with its Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We have never been forced to have the sort of reckoning that Germany had after World War II, when it held the Nuremberg trials and it held people to account for their crimes against humanity. And slavery was a several hundred years old crime against humanity. America's never really reckoned with that. And so this lingers and festers in the visible symbol of these monuments in some way.
Right, I agree. And so if we're going to be honest and move forward, we have to have accountability. We have to be truth tellers. We have to come together because this is our collective history.
All right, lots of calls. Let's go to them right now at 549-2937. Richard is downtown. Go ahead, Richard. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I just want to say that I think that most of the statues that you're talking about were probably put up in that era when the Confederate Park came about, which is probably in the 20s and 30s. But, you know, I'm a person who was born and raised in the South, but I don't like people displaying the Confederate flag because I think it represents a wrong idea and a wrong ideal. So I don't appreciate that at all. But on the other hand, the statue of Confederate generals, or take someone like Robert E. Lee, who was caught in between. He didn't know whether to fight for his country or his state, and he couldn't fire on the people who lived in the state. So we have to think of the times and know that some of these people were caught in a web and they couldn't get out of it. The other thing is. Listen, we have a big celebration of Thomas Jefferson, who was a slave owner. George Washington was a slave owner. I just think that we need to, like I said, somebody can displaying the Confederate flag. I don't like it because I think it's in the face of people who were wrong. But I have no problem with the statues at all.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Thanks for that call. Wayne Wood.
Yeah, I share some of those same thoughts. The idea of monuments in public are the symbolism that they give. For example, we mentioned the General Kirby Smith statue in the Capitol in Washington, D.C. It has indeed been taken down. And remarkably—
Oh, that has come down.
Yes,
I stand corrected.
And it's not in the rotunda anymore. And it is, it was designed by Jacksonville sculptor Charles Adrian Pillars, who also did the Memorial Park statue. And it's a work of art as well as a historic monument. So we're trying to get that statue back in Jacksonville. The question is, where do you put it? I mean, these are the dilemmas that we have because these men were patriots. We have to remember that. They may be on the wrong side of history, but they were fighting for their homeland, and their history can't be denied. And at the same time, we need to review them in modern context.
Sandra is in St. Augustine. Hi, Sandra. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Sandra Parks calling from St. Augustine.
Oh, yes. The widow of civil rights icon Stetson Kennedy calling into the show. Hi. Good morning to you. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. And good morning, Wayne. Wayne Wood served on the Stetson Kennedy Foundation Board. I'm really intrigued by the comment that Shavara made about reframing the narrative. What does it take to reframe the narrative? Well, at least one step in that would be Wayne's solution, that we need to honor individuals who should be honored nationally who happen to have lived in Jacksonville. That's a part of reframing the narrative. But where these monuments remain, it speaks a story. It's a symbol of a part of our history, but also a reminder that for generations, Southerners refused to acknowledge either the abuses of slavery or the abuses of Reconstruction. So I would suggest that there should be a kind of reinterpretation council of historians, of art activists in Jacksonville to survey these monuments as they've been documented, determine what they're saying, and what should be done about them on an individual basis. For example, having the Confederate monument in Hindman Park gives it much more visibility and honor than perhaps we would want to go forward with. Perhaps it should be moved elsewhere into perhaps a spot that can carry on conversation about the whole narrative. But there's another aspect of this that Stetson was particularly excited about. We visited Madison, Florida, where there is a statue in the middle of its Central Park that honors the millions of African Americans whose labor made the business enterprise of Madison County possible. We should not just be honoring the African American heroes of Jacksonville, but finding a way to also interpret the contributions of millions of African Americans who made the community what it is. So I think I really celebrate this conversation that you're having this morning, but let's do this systematically. Let's decide what these monuments are saying and to whom, and where do we want them to be for the benefit of all the people of Jacksonville.
Thanks for that call. Sandra Parks calling in.
I really appreciate your comments, Sandra, and it's interesting because in 1861, Mississippi, as they were proclaiming their own secession declaration, they commented that the slave labor trade supplies the product which constituted by far the largest and most important portions of the commerce of the earth. So you're absolutely correct that we should be paying homage and commemorating the lives of those people upon who the backs of our community was built.
As you pointed out, Joe White, at the same time, there's been a tremendous outpouring of emotion around the fact that for many white Southerners, this debate is extremely painful and personal to have.
Sure, and that was one of the interesting things, I think, about writing the story and learning a little bit more just on my own. When you have, let's take Lee High School. Lee High School is one of the oldest schools in Jacksonville. The names of past city leaders who've gone to Lee High School would fill a phone book. Then you compare that to what was once Forest High School and how that came to be. And you look at the establishment of Lee as a high school and then Forest when it was named specifically at a time. And it was kind of a jab at the civil rights movement, saying this is why we're going to name this school. So you can have, you can have two schools. And you can have two names, but they can stand for really different things, even though in the context of history, they might have some common ground.
And look at the long and fractured debate over renaming Nathan Bedford Forrest High School. Look how long that took and how controversial that was.
Well, we need to keep history in perspective, and we don't want to tear down our history. We want to make people more aware of it. And sometimes the painful parts of our history are just as important to retain as long as we keep them balanced and in perspective. The case of Forest High School was a pretty egregious one because it was named that, I believe, in the 1940s or 50s during the birth of a civil rights movement. It wasn't historically that name, whereas Robert E. Lee, the day it opened, it was celebrating the great patriot of the South, Robert E. Lee.
Still, though, he fought to preserve an institution which held millions of people in bondage.
That's unquestionably the whole heart of this debate, and why, as Sandra said a moment ago, it should be deliberated very carefully, and I would love to see a commission of historians from all sides, art advocates, and folks who feel passionately on both sides to have this debate and decide what to do with these monuments to our public, our history.
We're streaming the show live on our Facebook page right now. Lots of comments there. Lori writes, I concur that we leave the monuments but change the narrative, lest we forget over time and repeat our mistakes. Tracy writes, I attended an Undoing Racism workshop over the weekend, and it allowed me to understand from an historical perspective that this nation was and is built on a white supremacist ideal. Okay, let's go to a few more calls. Hope in Avondale. Go ahead, Hope. Thanks for holding.
Hi. I just wanted to speak on behalf of the process that is undertaking the removal of the monument at in the Senate building in Washington, D.C. I'm a member of the Florida Council for Arts and Culture, and we have voted for that to be removed and are in the process of selecting what important figure from the state of Florida will actually now be in Statuary Hall. And we're talking about people like Mary McLeod Bethune being part of that replacement. So I just wanted to give that update and to be able to share with you that as painful as this is, it is happening across the country, and there's important precedents for both removing these monuments when they no longer seem appropriate, which many of them do not, or providing a new context for them.
Okay, thanks for that call. Mary McLeod Bethune, not enough people know her name. Let's talk about that. If Kirby Smith gives way to Mary McLeod Bethune in Washington, at the same time we're seeing Andrew Jackson give way to Harriet Tubman on our currency, at a certain point that's going to happen.
Right. And so I think that, you know, it is exciting that we are engaging in this community in this dialogue, but I say let this simply be a stepping stone, because talking about the memorials, the statues, and the symbols is one thing. We also need to delve into our textbooks, and we need to talk about who owns history, who's telling history, how does that manifest itself from the Florida Theater, for example. If you go to the website, there's an amazing history that's listed there, but no mention that when it was built, Black people did not have access and had to go to La Villa. So we are really missing an opportunity, I think, in every aspect of our community to revisit the narrative and really collectively tell the story that belongs to all of us.
And by the way, Mary McLeod Bethune was an educator, a civil rights activist, a humanitarian who hailed from Daytona Beach, right nearby. She advised President Roosevelt on civil rights and was known as the First Lady of the Struggle for Civil Rights. So that gives you a little bit more about her and why there was an effort to honor her. Okay, Conrad in Arlington. Go ahead, Conrad. Thanks for holding. Conrad, give us a call back. Oh, are you there?
Yeah, hey. I didn't hear you. I just wanted to say that I don't think that there should be a debate about our Sentinel in the park down there. I remember selling journal, the Jacksonville Journal on the corner of Monroe and Main, and walking by there from the Journal building in the afternoons, and he's up there on his pedestal, and if you're a kid, you realize what he's about, you pop him a smart salute and tell the Sentinel to carry on. I still do that as my own tradition, but I went to Kirby Smith in Jackson Junior High and High School. Kirby Smith has no real roots in this town whatsoever. He was born in St. Augustine. He was in charge of what they call the Western Mississippi, I believe it was, contingent of the Confederate Army west of the Mississippi River all the way over into Texas. He had the honor of being the last general to surrender because he did not get word that Robert E. Lee had surrendered a month before at Appomattox. They were still out there fighting in Texas a month later when the word finally got through to him. He was never in Jacksonville to speak of. Andrew Jackson shut down the first secession by South Carolina in 1832. He had nothing to do with the Confederacy. He was
definitely dedicated to keeping the Union intact in 1832 when he stopped the first South Carolina nullification, which allowed the Northern industrialists and bankers to become millionaires and billionaires as they shipped the Southern cotton produced by slave labor into the European markets for 29 more years, thanks to the Southern general who stopped the first attempt at secession. But I have so many mixed feelings about this. I am far too quick to use the term carpetbagger. I offend a lot of my friends who are incursionists here. But my family doesn't go all the way back to the war either. I'm only five generations, but I grew up in the Broward.
You're only five generations. Yeah. I'm sorry. Where'd you say you grew up?
Since the fire.
Okay.
But I grew up on the Broward lands in the old Duval County between Trout River and the Nassau Sound and the Broward River. And when you read the history of what the Reconstructionist courts and the scallywags and the enterprising opportunists did to Colonel John Broward simply because he had a 50,000-acre Spanish land grant that they stripped him of because he had owned slaves.
Okay, Conrad.
This county had 25% of the landowners' homesteads in this county were freedmen at the time the war broke out. That is a strange twist in the history of this particular county.
Did not know that. Wow, you really know your history. Thanks for that call.
Yeah, Mr. Wood can probably reinforce that. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. He really knows his stuff there, doesn't he?
Well, and he's a good example of the passion that this debate draws up. And there are those who like myself, go back and have relatives who fought in the Civil War. And we're proud of those as patriots, but the causes which they fought for need to be reviewed in light of today's reality.
Do you agree with that, Joe White?
Oh, certainly. And one of the things that popped in my head just sitting here, you know, you can't, if you go to a city like Paris, you can't walk down the street without tripping over some historical marker, a fountain, a statue, or something that's, you know, commemorating some point in history. In Jacksonville, since we don't have a lot of that, I think some of these monuments, you know, maybe they stand out a bit more because there isn't a lot of these other things that are brought up, and so that visual weight is more on one side than the other. And so I think, like we were saying earlier, there's a lot here to be excited about and learn about, and maybe we just do a poor job at that.
Yeah, I agree. One of the communities that we don't have a monument to is the community of Cosmo in East Arlington, and that was the first community of freed slaves. And so when we think about the descendants of those people, they don't even know it was there. So yet another opportunity for us to engage our community in our collective truth and history.
Here's an email from Clyde. I have two thoughts. The first is that the country paid an atonement in the blood of 600,000 deaths. I'm assuming he's talking about the Civil War, 95% white. And surely we have realized very slowly the truths that would come out in a new truth and reconciliation process. The problems today are not just the offensive symbols, but the bigger problem of sustained racism. We gave in to these bigots after World War II, and I think he's talking about the movement to expand these symbols. And most recently, and maybe in another period of open bigotry, the only weapon to battle this is to encourage the rest of the country to shame such bigotry openly and actively. All right, let's go to Pam in Mandarin. Hi, Pam. Good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Oh, hi.
Hey.
Yes, I do agree with the fallen soldiers that have gone to, when they didn't have any choice, that they had to go to war, and the fallen soldiers that a lot of these symbols do represent. I was not born here in Jacksonville. I was born in Illinois, but I moved here and was raised here, so I've been here since I was five. I still think of myself as young. I'm 57, but I do remember when we first moved here, we lived in the Springfield area, and I remember riding the city bus with my grandmother to Henning Park for traveling, and she said, "You're not allowed to sit on the back of the bus because that's for coloreds only." I remember going to Woolworth and seeing water fountains, and it seems like not that long ago that the water fountains were for whites and coloreds. Woolworth, May Cohen's, Ivy's, all of those. I can remember all of those. So I can certainly sympathize with what the African Americans feel like, and because I really believe that that's wrong. But my question and my concern is, I can go to Washington, D.C., and I see statues there that are offensive to me, George Washington dressed like a Greek god in a toga. But when we begin to try to be all things to all people, for instance, my mother attended Kirby Smith, and she went to Andrew Jackson. So if we're going to start down this path, where does it end? Do we not support the Japanese? Because my father-in-law, he fought in World War II. He fought in the Korean War. Where does it end when we start segregating all of these different symbols and status symbols because it's offensive?
Right.
To us.
Yeah. Exactly. I hear your point, Pam. Yeah. I hear your point.
The logic of it doesn't make sense to me. It will just go on and on. We're always going to be offended at some point in our life. But to blend everything and try to be all things to all people, we will become with nothing. We'll stand for nothing at all.
Thanks, Pam. So, and we're running a little tight on time. I appreciate your thoughts. So that, I think her comments sum up why this is a difficult conversation for this community to have.
Certainly, and for us to write it, you know, to put it in the magazine, the idea was never to, we were going to provide the answers. The idea was to say, here's something that's obviously worth discussing, and as we've seen, it brings out emotion and historical reference, and it's great to have people like Wayne here who can put a lot of stuff in context.
And Wayne and Shavar, do you foresee Jacksonville having any further movement on this issue as other cities have undertaken?
Well, I don't think we should do anything to try to hide our history. Even our bad history is illuminating for the future. At the same time, we do have these monuments that are prominent, like the one in Hemming Park that has been there for all this time, and they need to be carefully considered before changes are made, and perhaps finding the balance to represent those parts of history that have been underrepresented is the key to going forward.
I agree. I do also think there is danger in normalizing hate, and the caustic language and actions of the most recent election certainly are indication of that, and it's shaken our nation to its very core. And still far too many, not just across the nation, but in this community, are inspired by the ideology of a Confederate past. So I do believe it's critically important that the narrative be reframed, that all of us, our collective voices, are a part of the decision-making going forward in our community regarding these statues and symbols.
Thanks for being with us. Shavar Oren, Joe White, and Wayne Wood joining the show. We appreciate it. And in a moment, the grandson of Nelson Mandela speaks at UNF Today, a preview right after this.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Indivisible is a live national conversation about America in a time of change.
I just hope that for our president, he can gain an appreciation that, you know, the troops are not really meant to be a prop.
I have a son who's in the Marines now, and I'm nervous.
I'm Kai Wright. Tune in or call in. Join us Monday through Thursday for the first 100 days of the new presidency. There's a seat at this table for everyone.
On the next Fresh Air, we look back on a chapter of paranoia and persecution in America in which the president, Congress, the courts, and the press all played a part. We'll talk with journalist Glenn Frankel, whose new book is about the Hollywood blacklist and the making of the classic film High Noon. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Independent music transcends genre, form, and age. At Indie Endeavor, we endeavor to shine a light in the little explored dark corners of your musical imagination. Everything from new to old, foreign to domestic, electronic to acoustic, we play it all. Indie Endeavor Tuesdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, he's the grandson of former South African president and global icon Nelson Mandela, and also the co-founder of Africa Rising. That's a global foundation promoting a positive vision of Africa. Nedaba Mandela is the guest speaker today at UNF, speaking on From Prisoner to President. The Mandela legacy lives on. It's part of the school's 36th annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Scholarship Luncheon. We're pleased to have a preview right now as we welcome Nedaba Mandela to Studio 5. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I hope you're enjoying your time here in Jacksonville. You'll be speaking later today at the Dr. King Scholarship Luncheon, and you're the co-founder of Africa Rising. That's an organization promoting Africa throughout the world. Really exciting to learn more about this. How did Africa Rising begin, and how much was it inspired by your grandfather's legendary presence in South Africa?
Well, firstly, let me thank President John Delaney and Marisa Gonzalez for the university for having me here in Jacksonville, Florida. Basically, how our organization started was that I realized through my travels that people have very limited knowledge on Africa, and the little information that they have is what is perpetuated by the mainstream international media, that Africa is a place of poverty, war, disease, dictators, and the only positive thing to Africa is safari.
Going to look at lions in Kenya.
Exactly. Okay. Let's forget about the human beings.
Right.
Anyway, so we then went back home and called a couple of friends, and three times more people came to the meeting because the word spread. And we realized that this was not something special about us, but it was in the hearts and minds of youth. And so it became a non-profit organization geared towards building a new generation of African leaders that would empower themselves to be at the forefront of Africa's development through education, through entrepreneurship development, and celebrating African culture.
And there's a lot that's happened, particularly in the last decade, that we'll be learning more about today at your luncheon speech.
Yes, there's been lots of development across many parts of the continent. Mm-hmm. But one of the most notable things I must say is that, you know, we always look down upon Africa. But when you look at the economies of the world, mm-hmm. past 2 years, the most developing nations in the world have been in Africa. Out of the top 10 growing economies, seven of those are on the continent of Africa. Mm-hmm. And many people don't know that. You know, if you want to learn about yourself, you must learn about your history and understand. It doesn't matter whether you're in China or in America or in Europe, humanity began in Africa.
Right. You had this incredible blueprint for leadership from your grandfather. How much of your activism is inspired by him, and how much is of your generation? You're the new generation of leadership in South Africa.
Yes, of course. You know, our grandfather is probably one of the most revered and loved leaders in the world. And of course, I was very lucky to grow up with my grandfather and learn from him. And so he's a constant inspiration for us. He talks about courageous leadership. You talk about leadership with humility, compassionate leadership that cares about the people, that puts people at the forefront. So he's really everything for me. He really made me the man I am today.
Tell us a little bit more about how Africa Rising carries this message around the world. And I'm also curious to ask you about what it's like in South Africa today, decades after the fall of apartheid and your grandfather's activism finally bore fruit. For people here in this country, they're not really familiar with Africa, and particularly South Africa, beyond, as you said, what they read in the headlines. It's a much more complex picture than what most Americans understand to be. And so I guess two questions. Africa Rising and how it has grown and spread this message, and also South Africa today.
Well, one of the ways is through my speaking engagements. I've been doing this professionally now for over 3 years. And, you know, I talk to people to say, go and discover it for yourself. It is not that dangerous. It is not as fearful as you think it is. Actually, start in South Africa, where you might feel a little bit at home in Cape Town, where it's very Eurocentric. The buildings, the way it's built, is very Eurocentric. And then delve into the real Africa, Johannesburg, and then into the rest of the continent. And you will see some of the most amazing things that you will see. And of course, we work primarily on the continent, working with the rural communities, the poorest communities, to give them that sense of hope, that sense that they are the masters of their own destiny. And so majority of our work is mainly on the continent. But of course, it is important for us to engage with the global community to make them understand that they also have a role to play to break down these misconceptions that they have. Africa is a place where you can go for holiday. Africa is a place where you can go and start a business and be successful and get much better returns than you will get in your local bank. So those are the kinds of things that we engage in. And as far as our country, it has grown tremendously from the dark days of apartheid. When you talk about South Africa, you talk about one of the most robust sort of projects when providing people with free housing. You know, our government has built over 1 million houses that they give to our people for free. You know, it doesn't exist anywhere else in the world.
That's not a data point most Americans know anything about. Just learned a new fact.
You know?
Yeah.
But, of course, everything is not going to be all rosy. You know, there will be struggles. There will be up and downs. You know, take one step back, two steps forward, you know. So it's a constant sort of challenge in ourselves. And again, it becomes very important that you have the right leaders at the helm. And currently we have a challenge of leadership, not only in South Africa, but right here in America and across the world. So that is one of the most important things that we're grappling with as a society, as a world. And particularly with the youth, we have to look into ourselves and say, guys, now is the time for us to organize ourselves, to unite, to work through our differences and to choose the best leaders that we can, because currently there is a huge vacuum that exists.
Will one of those future leaders be you?
Well, if the people choose me, then I will definitely rise up to the occasion.
Would you, do you foresee a run for the presidency of your country at some point?
I think it may be something that may fall within my responsibility. I think it is my obligation. It is what we have to do. You know, if you want something done, you have to do it yourself.
Well, we will certainly be watching from across the ocean your rise and your career. It's such an honor to meet you, and we so appreciate you being on the program this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nedaba Mandela speaks later today on the UNF campus. He joined us this morning. He is the co-founder of Africa Rising and the grandson of Nelson Mandela. And we'll be right back.
I'm Joshua Johnson. On the next 1A, the president's crackdown on illegal immigration. draft guidelines from the Homeland Security Secretary give the feds more power to detain and deport undocumented immigrants. Those guidelines do not seem to target younger immigrants brought to the country as children, better known as dreamers. Who gets to stay and who decides if they should go? That's next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Ira Glass of This American Life, and a listener left us this voicemail.
My roommate and I, several years ago, used to live in an apartment complex where we couldn't get the public radio station, so we used to go out to her car, like, kind of drive back and forth in the parking lot until we got reception. And we'd sit in the car and we'd drink beer and we'd listen to This American Life.
Radio worth going out of your way for this week. Saturday afternoons at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Presenting Next Avenue, the website from WJCT created specifically for adults discovering life after 50. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's where grown-ups keep growing. Sponsored in part by AARP. Real possibilities.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's a celebration of the world of STEAM. That's science, technology, engineering, art, and math. The fifth annual Jacksonville Science Festival is coming up this weekend. We've got an all-star panel right now as we welcome Nadia Hianides of the Foundation Academy. That's a school that founded the Jacksonville Science Festival. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ashley Archer is here, academic director at FSCJ, the festival co-presenter.
Good morning.
Eddie Whistler, director of the Brian Gooding Planetarium at the Museum of Science and History.
Good morning.
And adding the art to STEAM, Jessica Santiago, founder of Art Republic. Good to see you on the show.
You as well. Thank you for having me.
Really exciting to see the Science Festival back in town again. Nadia, this is a way to really promote science education. What's going to be happening?
Well, it's going to be amazing because between these partnerships that you just heard from and you introduced, we're going to have many booths that are both from college level, professionals, but most importantly, it is student-driven, student-led, project inquiry-based learning presentations with interactive science activities that students actually lead, so it's 10 times more fun.
Ashley, 2 days of events on the FSCJ South Campus, mm-hmm. and then Metropolitan Park will be more of the festival on Saturday. People can come out to this, students, teachers, parents, kids. You want everybody to come to this.
Yes, yes. It's going to be a great event. We have over 2,000 school kids that we're expecting on Thursday and Friday, but we do want the public to come. We want everyone to come out and enjoy it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
And let's talk about, Eddie, let's talk about Mosh's involvement. How is Mosh participating in the festival?
Several different ways. We're doing presentations on a live stage. We also have like tabletop demonstrations that we do around town for outreaches. And I'm involved in putting together student art for the program as well. It's called the Informed Art Project, and students in art class doing art with a focus on some science concept.
Very cool. Now, people tend to think of this as STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, but the new acronym is STEAM, adding the A for art. Jessica Santiago, you made a big splash in town with Art Republic. For people that have driven around downtown Jacksonville, they've seen these incredible large murals on public buildings. You're also the founder of the Wall Street Art Gallery. How does art factor into this science festival?
We are very big believers in the merging of all of these different academic realms, and looking at how art has elevated them has really been amazing, and the work that Nadia does at Foundation Academy is truly at the heart of both Art Republic and Wall Street, is to help youth really encompass that kind of creative energy from a young age, and what she's doing over there was just so incredible that we could not be a part of it.
You're getting kids excited about learning and excited about science and tech, and which is so important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really, you need something to drive you. And project-based learning, which includes arts, you can come at academics from any angle. and then you give back through the presentation, mm-hmm. through the Science Festival.
So FSCJ, one of the sponsors of this event, let's get the information out, how people can participate. By the way, it's jacksonvillesciencefestival.org to go to the website. But FSCJ South on Beach Boulevard
right.
is where things are going to mm-hmm. kick off, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, 11901 Beach Boulevard.
Free festival?
Yes.
Yeah. People can come out the 23rd, 24th, and 25th. And having the mosh as part of this is also continuing the tradition. So good to see Museum of Science and History part of this as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Again, it's jacksonvillesciencefestival.org. And you had one more comment?
Very important. On February 25th, it's at Metropolitan Park. And it begins at 10 and it goes till 3. And there'll be murals and artists there painting, as well as all these other things that you heard of. So Metropolitan Park on February 25th.
Yeah, if you can't make the festival during the week, work week, come on out on Saturday. And thanks to all of you for being with us. Again, that website, jacksonvillesciencefestival.org. Have fun.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Have a great one.
That's our show. 1A's up next with a look at guidelines now in place to expand the power of U.S. authorities to detain and deport illegal immigrants. That's coming up. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.